and we lived together. It was the end of university. It was time to pack up our house. It was like the world was ending and starting again. That's how it felt before. We had no idea. None.
Suze rubbed her mouth with the back of her fist to prepare herself.
We went to Merriweather, she said. That's the name of the house. You've probably heard that. It belonged to Sebastian's family. It's his now, along with the title of Viscount. We'd go there every once in a while on breaks when the family was away. Incredible place. I grew up in a little house outside of Southampton. I'd never seen anything like it. It was magical. We drove down in two cars. It was hot that day. There was a heat wave that summer. We were blasting Park Life the whole way. That's an album by Blur. Blur is a band. You've probably never heard of them. But they were the biggest thing, remember?
It was a huge story that summer,
Peter said.
Blur and the other major band of the moment, Oasis, had had a public dispute and were challenging one another. Everyone took a side and had an opinion on which band was better.
Oasis, Suze said. Most of the others thought otherwise. I was the only one standing up for the Gallagher brothers.
They released a single on the same day, and there was a huge furor about which band would come up on top.
Peter went on.
They called it the Battle of Britpop. So funny to think of that. It was such a bright summer, and the big controversy was whose band was best.
We arrived well into the evening, Suze said. Remember? We left late because most of us had hangovers and we'd been packing up the house. We got there right as it was getting dark and the rain started. We ran around and picked our rooms. That was always fun.
Her brow furrowed. She'd hit a memory.
Something was odd, she said. Rosie was in a strange mood the whole way there, I remember. Something to do with Julian. Rosie had been dating Julian, and things with Julian were always... She shook her head.
Drama, Peter said. There was always some drama about Julian.
Not just Julian, Suze said. We were all big, passionate, messy. But yes, that day was about Julian. I knew what that could be like. I dated him twice, and for most of our second year. Julian and Rosie were together for most of our last year, and they split up right near the end. At least Rosie was in the process of leaving him for Noel. That last week we were at Cambridge, I saw them going off together. We had this tatty tent. Someone bought it for a festival and put it up in the back garden afterward, and we never took it down. We'd go in there sometimes. It was disgusting, muddy, moldy, but private. I saw Rosie and Noel slipping in there during finals week.
Did Rosie and Julian fight? Stevie asked.
No idea, probably. Not a serious fight. Not anything, not violent. Stupid things. Julian was, and still is, very, very attractive. Everyone flirted with him, and he flirted right back. When you were with Julian, things got messy. He wasn't always faithful. And by that, I mean he was never faithful. Who is at that age? I had my moments as well, but Julian was the worst of us when it came to that. But he could have been angry with Rosie and Noel, right? Stevie said.
Suze wrapped her hands around her teacup and tucked her knees together as she considered her reply.
No, she said.
No?
That's not how it was with us.
And Julian had no right to complain about anyone, Peter added.
Oh, God, Yash said. We're always talking about Julian.
What I mean, Suze said, is that we were... A sort of a commune, almost. We always shared things with each other. Anything you brought into the house, you knew it belonged to everyone. By the end, I don't think any of us knew which clothes were ours.
If you found it on the drying rack, it was fair game.
Clothes, bicycles, hairbrushes, books, food. There were no possessions in our house. And in a way, no possessiveness. I think we all dated each other at some point. There were so many showmances. Even though we all dated and broke up, we were friends. I mean, Yash, you and I got together in our first year. And Peter, you and I had a good year in there, right?
The two shrugged and indicated this was so.
We might be heartbroken or furious, but the others would get you through it. We were constantly annoyed with each other. Constantly, always.
but we were always loyal as well. If Rosie stopped dating Julian and started dating Noel, that was within the bounds of how we did things. There was always a frisson of tension. It was quite exciting, actually.
More than a frisson, Yash said. The atmosphere could be thick.
But that was the fun of it, Suze said. The undercurrent. Anything could happen.
And usually did, Peter replied, loudly. At all hours. Frequently against the wall we shared with Julian's bedroom. That's why I can sleep anywhere now.
Yash stretched and cracked his neck.
I once fell asleep during a performance of Stomp, during the part where they're banging the dustbin lids. Lulled me right off.
Anyway, Suze waved her hand, moving the topic along. Rosie was up in her room with Angela having a chat, and I dragged them downstairs for champagne. We had quite a lot of champagne that night, and some other things as well. It started to pour down with rain, and then we were going to play our game. It was team hide and seek. Sebastian was the seeker, the rest of us hid. There weren't many rules, just you couldn't go back inside once you went out, and the outbuildings were out of bounds.
Sebastian shoved his keys down the front of his trousers, Peter said. Remember that?
Oh, yes, Yash said.
The last any of us saw of Rosie and Noel was as we ran out into the rain in the dark. They never came back in. What we figured is that they were off shagging somewhere. The next morning, they still hadn't come back in. Sebastian and Theo went out to look for them. She trailed off.
Theo and Sebastian found them, Peter said quietly.
That was clearly the end of what they were prepared to say on the matter. You have a lot of pictures, Stevie said to Suze.
Oh, yes. I was the photographer of the group. You used to have to buy film and get it developed, and it was expensive. But I knew someone who worked at Boots who developed my pictures for free, so I took loads and loads of them.
Did you take any? Stevie proceeded carefully. That weekend?
I did, she said.
Would you mind? Izzy said. I know it's a bit of a strange ask, but could we see them?
Suze nodded.
Of course. I'll go and get them.
She was gone only a moment and returned with three black paper sleeves full of printed photographs.
These are the last photographs I took of all nine of us, she said, crossing her arms over her chest and looking down at the sleeves. I've never been able to digitize them. I don't even like looking at them. I keep them separate. I don't know how they could help, but if anything helps find Angela, go ahead, feel free.
She waved her hand toward Stevie, indicating she was welcome to examine the photos. She tucked herself back on the sofa.
Some are from the week or so leading up to our going away, she said. I'd just gotten the first two developed before we left for Meriwether. I remember showing them to the others in the car. I took the last roll while we were there. For a long time, I couldn't pick up my camera again. There's about 6 months between the photos and that last pack.
There was a lot of red eye. Flashes caught in windows and mirrors. No filters. Just people glancing up from their lives and being caught in a moment, bent over to pick up a beer or a book, making faces behind each other's backs. The same nine people, over and over. Occasionally there would be someone else on the side of the image, but the stars of the show were always the same.
Look at this,
Peter said, holding up a picture of a bald Angela.
Remember, Anne shaved her head right before we went away.
Oh, yes, that's right, Suze said. That was a game of truth or dare. We were all a bit stoned. Sebastian had some powerful joints. He grew his own special blend.
I think I set that dare.
Didn't think she'd do it.
I thought she looked great. Very Sinead O'Connor.
This one,
Yash said, pulling one out of the stack.
This is probably the last one of all of us together. It was taken when we arrived at Meriwether.
He handed Izzy and Stevie a group photo. Nine people. Goofy smiles, suitcases, looking a little worse for wear and very happy. And there, behind them all, was a structure. Gray wood, plain, with a little closed window above the door.
That's it, Suze said quietly. That's the shed. That's where
That's the place. We took the photo there because we'd just arrived, and I put the camera on the car and set the timer. When I saw it later, saw what I had in the photo. She was unable to continue.
What were they like?
Stevie asked. It was a good question to ask to get people to open up and talk.
Rosie?
Suze let out a short laugh.
Rosie was fierce. She was from Dublin.
Stubborn, Peter said, nodding. She could drink with the best.
And how? Yash confirmed. I once saw her drink 12 pints in an afternoon. 12! Barely had an effect on her.
She was incredibly loyal, Suze went on. If you had a problem, day or night, Rosie was there for you. If you were sick, Rosie was by your side. If she was mad at you, you knew it. She was wonderful. And so funny. I don't think I've ever met anyone as funny as Rosie. She would have been famous. I believe that.
I could see Rosie hosting Bake Off now, Peter said. Or doing panel shows. She'd have been great on our show,
Yash added.
Noel.
Suze let her gaze drift to the ceiling.
When I first got to Cambridge and met everyone, Noel was someone I couldn't figure out. He seemed very straight-laced, serious, really into poetry. He played the straight man in comedy brilliantly. He played baddies as well. You could play off Noel in any scene. He had that gift. He kept his feelings close to his chest, but I believe that all along Noel was in love with Rosie. I felt it. I could see it. But he didn't work up the courage until the very end. I'm glad that, at the end, they had a moment.
Peter cleared his throat, and Yash looked toward the window.
Right, Suze said, collecting herself. We're going to figure this out. Despite being absolute rubbish, Julian's done well for himself and does good work. He's an MP. I know he's making inquiries. He'll call everyone in the world if he has to. I trust him on that. And he's maybe the only one of us who can do something directly. But we're going to do all we can. I've been posting online. We've all been. Whatever you need from us, you ask.
Day or night, Peter said. And wherever she is, Yash said, off looking for Henry VIII's old pants or whatever she's doing. We're going to give her an earful when she's home. It'll be all right, Izzy. You have all of us. And we never leave each other alone.
15. So, Stevie said, all of these people slept with each other all the time. That's a lot of what we learned. The group was seated around a large circular booth in a restaurant in Chinatown in Soho. Over plates of Singapore noodles, hor fun, and shredded duck pancakes, they told Janelle, Nate, and Vi about the information they had gleaned from Suze, Peter, and Yash.
Also, Izzy reached for a spring roll. Everyone seems mad at Julian a lot. Julian Reynolds. He's an MP from up north. He has a good track record on issues, but he's been in the papers for having a lot of partners. All of it is interesting, but it doesn't tell us anything about where my aunt is, does it?
Anything new from the police? Vi asked.
They say they're going to go through the CCTV tomorrow. It would be more helpful now.
Anything could be happening.
What the hell do I do?
Get the word out, Vi said. Post it everywhere.
This kind of thing was very much Vi's wheelhouse, and soon the table was in a discussion about graphics, messages, and influencers. After they finished their meal, they knocked together a flyer, got 1,000 copies made, and went up to Islington together to shove them into letter flaps and post them everywhere they could. By the time this was all over, it was almost midnight. They returned to Craven House with a heaving bag of junk food from Tesco Express and a sense of having done something in this general effort. When they reached the lobby, David and Stevie looked at each other.
Want to hang out?
David asked.
She did, in fact, want to hang out. They decided to go to his room. It was much like Stevie's in layout with a few more personal touches. But not, Stevie noted, as many as she expected. He hadn't been able to bring that much with him to England, so most of his things were new to her, and the room was sterile and blank. Which mattered not at all. The door was no sooner closed than he was kissing her,
backing her carefully toward the bed. She was reaching for it, trying to find it so she knew where to sit and when to lean back. He was on top of her, kissing along her chin, down to her chest. He was reaching up under her shirt, running his still cold hands over her stomach, up higher.
"All night,"
he said.
"We've been out there all night, and..."
She silenced him by putting her mouth on his, tugging her shirt up. They were working with frantic speed, and then came the fervent rapping on the door. David broke off the kiss. He closed his eyes and shook his head, then pulled down his shirt and leaned back as if nothing was going on. Stevie did the same.
"Come in,"
he yelled.
"There have been developments," Izzy said, rushing in, paying no attention to the close atmosphere in the room. "Two things. One, Julian got information. On the night she disappeared, my aunt got a call from an unknown mobile number at 9:53. That's right in the middle of the chain of texts. Here."
She pulled up Angela's texts and pointed to the spot. 9:46 p.m. Angela.
"She had the button."
9:47 p.m. Theo. Question mark? 9:48 p.m. Suze.
"What Theo said?"
9:48 p.m. Yash.
"Button?"
9:49 p.m. Peter.
"What?"
9:50 p.m. Suze.
"I have to go back on stage. Please, someone explain to me what is happening."
9:51 p.m. Sebastian.
"Can you ring me?"
9:55 p.m. Theo.
"Ange?"
9:57 p.m. Theo.
"Ange, can you pick up?"
9:58 p.m. Peter.
"I just rang as well, and it went to voicemail."
"So she mentions the button. That's the last time she speaks on this chain. The call comes right after Sebastian asks her to ring, and Peter says down here that her line is engaged and goes to voicemail. An unknown mobile number."
"That's not hard to do," David said. "Set up an online burner account."
"But someone went to the trouble," Stevie said.
"That seems bad."
Izzy wrapped her arms around herself.
"Very strange. She gets this unknown call and then she's gone. But there's more. Tonight, they all kept talking on the chain. They've all decided to meet at Merriweather. Tomorrow. They're going to spend the night. I had an idea. I texted Suze separately, pretending I didn't know about their going. I was saying how scary this situation is and talked my way into being invited. And then I asked to bring you, all of you, to Merriweather."
"Us?"
Stevie said.
"Where is it?"
"Gloucester, outside of Cheltenham. Only 2 hours or so on the train. I'm going mad here and there's nothing more I can do. The answer is there, isn't it? With them? We need to go where they are, and it will be all of them."
Stevie felt stupid having to explain that tomorrow they had a boat tour of the Thames to learn about the work of someone named Isambard Kingdom Brunel, who was apparently a very important Victorian-era engineer who made tunnels and bridges, but who looked like the kind of guy who had a basement full of urchins. Stevie didn't particularly care about this, but Janelle was eager and had been planning to do an essay about it.
"There's a train at noon that would get us there by mid-afternoon," Izzy said. "Please, this may be the chance to find out what's going on."
Stevie ran through the math in her mind. On one hand, missing person. On the other, limited time in England, every second of which was dripping away, and they had a schedule to follow or else. On the third hand, missing person who was present at a murder at a country house and thought something was up with that murder. On the fourth hand, officially too many hands now, it wasn't that she came here to be with David, but Manor House with David. Minutes later, Stevie walked back over to the other side of Craven House. She found everyone still awake, sitting in Vi's room and eating their feast of chips and cookies.
"So," she said, "something's come up. Hear me out."
She started with the positive approach. Didn't they all want to go to a manor house? They'd been invited by a Viscount, for whatever that was worth. She expected more enthusiasm than the tepid silence she was getting. Vi picked at the dust at the bottom of a bag of pickled onion-flavored chips, and Nate wrinkled his nose as if holding back a sneeze. Janelle met Stevie's eye.
"Stevie," she said, "I don't know if we can, or should, for a bunch of reasons. We only have 2 more days here. We still have all of Vi's and Nate's stuff to do. I mean, a manor house sounds cool, but it's just a house, and we have things here in London. Vi has an interview with the curator from the British Museum tomorrow. It's a big deal for them. They need it for their applications."
"The answer is there," Stevie said with increasing desperation. "Angela was on to something, or at least she was working on something. We show up, Izzy brings up the fact that Angela was talking about the lock when she was high, Angela sends a text to the others saying she needs to talk to them and they should go to Merryweather, and now she's gone. Wherever she is, it has something to do with what happened at Merryweather, and the way to find her is to find out what happened."
"We all get it. It's important that Izzy finds her aunt. We really do understand that. But her aunt vanished here, right? That's why we just helped with the posts.
Well, she was last seen here.
But what are the chances she's at Merryweather?"
Nate and Vi had gone silent and watched this back and forth warily. "Quinn isn't going to let us go," Janelle said. "She's already on edge with us here. We're supposed to follow the plan. If we say we're going to some manor house, she will look up that manor house. She will find out there was a murder there once. She will realize what is going on." This had already occurred to Stevie. She'd taken a few minutes back in David's room to look up Merryweather. The first link was to the official site, which was designed to entice couples looking for wedding venues and production crews looking for locations. It had a Wikipedia page, and various mentions of Christmas parties and weddings and gatherings held there. The gardens were apparently famous, and people came to visit them to see the flowers changing over the seasons. Sebastian had done a lot to make sure the murder stuff stayed out of the searches as long as possible. But if you kept looking, it was there, buried in the lines of a few old news articles. If you put in Merryweather and murder, it came up right away. It wouldn't be natural to do that, unless you were Dr. Quinn and you knew Stevie and her ways. The best answer she had come up with was, "What if we just went? For a little? One night? If we don't ask..." "Without telling her?" Janelle said. "Oh, she'd kill us. She will get on a plane to come and kill us with her hair." She had a point, of course. If Dr. Quinn found out that they had taken off across England to bust into a murder mansion, she would, in fact, kill them all with her hair.
"Stevie..."
Janelle brushed imaginary lint off her yellow sweater. It was the color of lemons, Janelle's favorite.
"We're in another country, and we need to graduate."
"I need to graduate too," Stevie said.
"I know that. I didn't say you didn't."
"So I can go," Stevie said. "On my own."
"So Quinn can expel you?" "For real, Stevie, have you even started your applications? I haven't seen you do anything."
"All that stuff is due soon. You have to make plans. You're always running after whatever shows up in front of you, but you can't do that forever." This was unexpected. Stevie felt it in her solar plexus. The thing that was never said, the thing she felt over her shoulder but kept telling herself wasn't there, it was real. Her friends saw her for what she was. Janelle and Vi and Nate, they were doing the work. And Stevie was a free-floating object, pinging around, looking for focus, looking at garbage. Janelle was almost shaking with upset. She got up and left the room. Vi followed her. Stevie heard them go to Janelle's room and shut the door.
"That didn't go well," Nate said.
"No."
"If one of us was missing," Nate said, "and you were worried, would you invite a bunch of strangers to come to your house when you were freaking out?"
"If one of those strangers solved things like that, I would."
"I think it's weird, and Janelle may have a point. Do you really think you can find her by going to Meriwether?
5 minutes ago, Stevie had been sure, but her confidence had been shot out. Her best friend had just leveled a heavy blow. A few minutes later, Vi came back with Janelle in tow. Janelle was quiet. There was still tension in her posture.
I'm sorry, she said.
When most people apologized, they looked down. Janelle looked right in Stevie's eye.
I worry, and we're on thin ice as it is. I have a proposal. If you call Quinn and she says we can go, I'll go.
And Vi said they would go.
Nate?
Nate shrugged a general acceptance of this plan.
But if she says no,
you'll stay, Janelle added.
We stick together. Deal?
It was 1 in the morning there, which meant it was 8 o'clock at night in Vermont.
She might be gone for the day, Stevie said.
Janelle shrugged as if to say, not much I can do about that.
Fine, Stevie said. It's a deal. I'll go call her.
Stevie returned to her room, her face flushed with anxiety.
Having Quinn call you was bad enough. Calling Quinn after hours was not a pleasant prospect. She had to be gone by now, off to some dinner or cocktail thing or a tryst with a lover or a meeting with a spy or whatever the hell it was Quinn did when not running Ellingham.
Stevie called the number, clenching and unclenching her fist involuntarily when...
It's late there, isn't it?
Dr. Quinn said. She was there, still at her desk, looking tired and puzzled.
Yeah. I wanted to ask something. Sorry it's late.
What is it?
She asked, indicating that Stevie should get on with it.
We've been offered a chance to go to this place called Meriwether. It's a manor house. The owner invited us. He's a...
How did you pronounce Viscount? She knew it wasn't the way it was written, but she couldn't remember the right way to do it.
He has a title, and he's a friend of someone here, and it's really nice. It has a site. You can see it.
And he invited you to do what?
Just visit for the night. It's sort of like a hotel, like a venue, so there are a lot of rooms.
A tapping sound on the other end. She was looking it up.
I see.
It has really famous gardens.
She could almost hear Dr. Quinn's synapses firing. This was the problem with having a smart head of school. She knew something was up. But her game always recognized game. Stevie had presented a highly suspicious but ultimately reasonable plan. The flaw was not obvious. She was intrigued. Tap, tap, click, click. She was looking it over.
It's a beautiful place, Dr. Quinn finally said. But I think you should stick to your schedule.
Okay, but we...
Stick to your schedule. You have enough to do in London. No side trips. I believe you have a tour tomorrow that focuses on Brunel. I think that's more important. Good night.
She was gone. Stevie sat on her bed, thinking. Angela Gill was missing. She needed help. Stevie was sure, that she could get at the answer at Meriwether. She was pretty sure, at least. It was a possibility, a strong one. But Quinn had said no. Stevie got up, took half an anxiety pill, gulped back the contents of a can of some drink she'd bought the day before and forgotten about, then returned to her friends.
She said yes.
Stevie arranged her expression into a mask of pleased disbelief.
It turns out she really loves gardens.
It was so easy to lie. So frighteningly easy. Excerpt from the witness statement of Peter Elmore, 24 June, 1995. Interviewer.
Can you tell me where you went when the game began?
Peter Elmore.
I went outside. Inside would have been nicer, but if you're playing the game, you have to play it.
There are more hiding places outside, more ground to move around.
How did you exit the house?
Through the library? Well, through the orangery that's connected to the library. I started off trying to hide in the gardens out that end, but there wasn't anywhere to go. I ended up going to the back gardens. Plenty more places there. It was bucketing down. I pressed myself under a bench.
And did you see Rosie or Noel at any point when you were outside?
No, I didn't see much aside from the ground.
And who found you?
Yash, and quite pleased he was about it, too. I was fine with it. I'd been there for ages, and I was freezing and had a cramp.
You became a seeker?
Yes, I was taken to the folly for my slicker and a torch. I managed to find Sue's almost straight away.
At any point did you approach or attempt to enter the woodshed?
I probably ran past it at some point, but I never went over to it. All the outbuildings were locked. Sebastian made sure we knew that.
What happened after the game was suspended?
We went back inside. We lit some candles. The fire was going in the sitting room. It had gone down a good bit since we'd been out, so we put more logs on it, got it going again. Sebastian was talking about some whiskey and was determined that we were going to drink it. He was making a tremendous fuss about it. That proved to be my undoing. I'd taken a bottle of champagne outside with me, and I had the entire thing, plus the drinks from before, plus whatever else. The whiskey was the last straw. I had to go upstairs and be sick. Then I got into bed. Theo came through with glasses of water. Then I woke up sometime around 11, I think, or noon. I felt all right, because you usually do after you're ill, don't you? Get it out of your system.
I've had that experience, yes. And you came downstairs?
Some of the others were awake. Rosie and Noel still hadn't come in. We were all feeling moribund. Someone, Julian maybe, said they wanted a fry-up. Eggs, sausages. Someone wanted Monster Munch. So we decided we were going to go to the shops. Theo and Sebastian went out to find Rosie and Noel and bring them in.
I understand there were two cars, one belonging to Sebastian and one to Noel. Which car did you take?
Sebastian's. Noel's keys were with Noel, I suppose. We drove to the shops, and when we came back, you were here. Not you, I don't think. But a police car, I mean.
I understand. I think that's all we need for the moment.
Excerpt from the witness statement of Yash Varma. 24 June, 1995. Interviewer.
Please tell me what you did when the game began at 11 o'clock.
Yash Varma.
I'm not a huge fan of the game, but I play it because that's what we do. There's a rule that once you leave the house, you can't go back in or you forfeit, so I decided to start inside and stay there as long as possible. I went and hid under a bed in one of the bedrooms. I wanted to be indoors.
And you were found?
Almost straight away. I thought it would take longer. I was a bit drunk. Thought I was being clever. Hiding under a bed isn't very clever.
So you, Sebastian, and Theodora were seekers?
Yes. Together we searched the house top to bottom, which probably took us an hour. We may have stopped to have a drink before going outside.
What time do you think you went outside?
Somewhere around midnight. We were all a bit reluctant to go, but we had to. It was absolutely bucketing down. Sebastian went down to claim a base position at the folly. And as we found people, we brought them to him.
Did you go past the woodshed in your searches?
Oh, yes, several times.
And you noticed nothing out of the ordinary?
Nothing at all.
Did you check the door to see if anyone had gotten inside?
Well, the outbuildings were all locked, so there was no need to go through them.
You didn't check?
No need. Sebastian had the keys. He stuffed them down the front of his trousers right in front of us.
Down the front of his trousers?
Yes, it looked quite painful.
Did you notice anything at all out of the ordinary?
Nothing.
Any cars on the drive, aside from the ones you came in?
Truly, there was nothing. and I was making loops of the house and grounds. I never saw a thing that I'd consider odd.
You found some people?
Yes, I found Peter. He was crouched under a bench in the back garden. His hiding spot was almost as bad as mine.
When was this?
Not sure. Within my first hour of searching, probably. This place is enormous.
Yes, it is substantial, isn't it? What happened with the rest of the time you were outside?
I know Peter found Suze hiding in some bushes. Ange had been found. There was a god-awful clap of thunder, and all of the lights in the house went out. We stayed outside for a few more minutes, found Julian hanging on top of the pergola, and then it was clear that we should get inside.
What happened when you returned to the house?
Sebastian was banging on about this special bottle of whiskey we had to try. It was very dark, and he was crawling across the floor, fumbling with his keys. It looked like he was doing battle with the cabinet. So Peter had to get down on the floor and help him unlock it before he pulled the wall down trying to get in there. We opened it, and we all had some. I had one glass, but by that point I was feeling it. We'd all had a lot. Angela had come to the end and went up to bed. Peter went upstairs to be sick for a bit. I didn't make it that far. I remember being ill in the downstairs loo. Then I crawled up the stairs and got into bed. I remember Theo putting a pint glass of water next to me, and that was it until morning.
Do you know what time this was?
I knew nothing by that point.
So you were in bed the rest of the night?
Yes.
Did you hear or see anything?
No, I was absolutely shattered. A plane could have landed next to me and I wouldn't have known. The next thing I remember was Theo again, back with some tea. It was morning.
16. In the morning, they were at Paddington Station, which Stevie was embarrassed to realize she hadn't known was real. She thought it was made up, for the bear. Paddington Station really wanted to sell her a Paddington bear. There had been no time to eat, but Paddington was rammed with restaurants. Stevie bought herself brie and apple on a baguette, a water, and the biggest coffee available. Then they headed off to the massive overhang where the trains came into the station. The box had to come with them. Whatever was in it, whatever it was, it would not be left behind. But it was clearly a fire safe, and they couldn't just turn up to Merryweather with a fire safe like that was normal. It would have to be hidden in something else. Stevie had pulled her suitcase from the corner of the room, tipped out the dirty clothes she had been storing in it, and managed to fit it inside. She had just enough room to wedge the onesie in with it. It was good packing material. So she dragged a massive, heavy suitcase full of fire safe behind her, and carried her supplies for the night in her backpack. There were some tables available, with four seats around them. She sat at one of these with David by her side, and Izzy and Nate across from them. Vi and Janelle sat behind, in a set of two seats. Stevie could hear them speaking gently to each other behind her head. Once they were on the train and the doors slid closed, they all settled in with their food. Izzy stared at her phone, preoccupied, hoping for updates that didn't seem to be coming. Nate was reading something on his. David also pulled out his phone to watch something, slouching over and tilting his head in Stevie's direction. The last views of London were the backs of houses, gray and brick, with neat rectangles of back gardens. She had done this. She had led her friends on this trip with a lie. Lies, she noted, took energy. They weighed a lot. She had to think about everything she said and did now to support the lie. It sat there in her head, giving off vibes. Lies were radioactive. She had to try to do something, figure something out. But she had so little to work with. She had Suze's photos. That would have to do. She pulled out her tablet to look at them and enlarge them, to take them in and make them part of her own memory. Noel was a beanpole in massive glasses and 70s clothes. Sebastian's character came through loud and clear. He almost always had a glass of something in his hand, and his posture was theatrical. Theo was often with him. Her hair was short, and she wore a multicolored sweater vest over a white t-shirt. Angela was often to the side in the pictures, smoking and watching. Peter and Yash tended to appear together.
Yash looked like he was 12, swamped in a massive t-shirt. He had no beard. He always appeared to be in the middle of explaining something or telling a joke, a smile cracking his face. Peter almost looked the same as he did now. His ginger blonde hair was floppier, but he looked much like the man Stevie had met. Rosie was small, with long blonde hair she often wore in pigtails. She too was often laughing in the pictures. The camera loved Julian, his blue eyes with their long lashes. He was the 90s incarnate, from his shell necklace to his flannel shirts to his boy band sweep of blonde hair. Suze took most of the pictures, so she wasn't in many. But when she was the star. In front, arms or legs spread, hugging, jumping, her massive brown eyes taking the focus. These were the players. The conversation from Suze's house began to play on a loose recording in her head, skipping and looping. One phrase was on repeat. When you were with Julian, things always got messy. He wasn't always faithful, and by that I mean he was never faithful. Who is at that age? That last sentence had changed her day, made her feel twitchy and cold. Was that a 90s thing, or was it true now? They were halfway through this trip to England. The journey had been a destination for so long, she had forgotten about the other side of it. The cliff edge, where she left, plummeted back to Earth. Every evening was closer to the last evening. Just like the Nine and their doomed trip to Merryweather, counting down to the last moments of togetherness. Behind her, Janelle and Vi were going through the schedule for the last full day of the trip. Tomorrow. Tea. Theater. After this, just one more full day. What is Richard III about? Janelle asked Vi. I've never read it, which I guess is embarrassing, but I don't really like Shakespeare. Who is at that age? College age is what Suze meant, which was around the age Stevie and her friends were now. David would remain here, in the warm air of pubs and the student house and the London tube. This was his life now. Who knew what would happen next? And they were spending so much time with Izzy, or doing something for Izzy, or related to Izzy. Izzy had done nothing wrong. She'd been complimentary, excessively so. She seemed to believe in Stevie more than anyone. But maybe that was something you did if you were covering for something, because apparently no one was faithful. Paranoia, Vi said. Stevie dribbled coffee down her chin and onto her tablet. It's about paranoia, Vi went on, and wanting a horse really, really bad, I think. I just read the Wikipedia entry. I've been thinking, Janelle said. Anyone was invited to listen, but it was mostly directed at Vi. Maybe I should do an engineering degree and then a medical degree to make medical devices. You can do that without being a doctor, but a doctor would really know how they'd be used, right? That's so much school, Vi said. You'd be in school forever. Well, the engineering degrees, those are 4 or 5 years, depending. I could get it done in 4. And then probably 1 year to do the pre-med requirements. Then 4 years of medical school. Then the intern period, which is somewhere around 3 or 5 years. That's so much school, Vi said again. You'd be in your 30s before you were done. Yes, but I could still make things all during that time. I don't know, it's just a thought. But if we were going to school in Boston, we'd have so many options. Or New York. The conversation fizzled quietly. Nate squeezed the air in the bag of potato chips he was holding, and it came open with a surprise pop. Pop. Something moved inside the dark corridors of Stevie's brain. Something was alive in there. An idea. A pop. A noise. An unexpected noise. Like a firework. A leftover firework from bonfire night. The big celebration every year to mark the time Parliament didn't explode. Get up, she said to David, who was still watching something on his phone. She nudged him out of his seat and went to the luggage area at the head of the car. She hauled her bag out. She knelt in the aisle, taking it up completely as she attempted to find the space to get it open. Someone was trying to get back from the bathroom and found Stevie on the floor in the way. Sorry, she said, tugging at the fire safe. 1 second. It was more than a second. It was an awkward struggle that took several minutes.
She lugged the fire safe back to the table, forcing everyone to clear cups and wrappers. She took the aisle seat, which David had vacated for the window one. "When you need to remember something," she said to the group, "you're a historian and you need to remember. What do you remember?" "Remember, remember. What's the date again? The date to remember, the one with the fireworks?"
"The 5th of November," Izzy said.
She tried 1105. Nothing. But that was the wrong way around, of course. Here it would be 0511. The case clicked open. 17.
"Well," David said, "will you holy shit that?"
The six of them were pressed around the little train table. Janelle and Vi leaned over David's and Stevie's seats. Before them, spread out in a neat array, was a selection of documents. Official documents. Police documents, mostly. Full-sized prints of 35 photographs. 7 witness statements. A copy of notes from the detective in charge of the case. Autopsy reports. A photocopy of a newspaper article. And on top, a note on lined notebook paper in what Izzy identified as Angela's handwriting. It read, "Order of events, times approximate." Right before game, Rosie said, "I saw something I didn't understand, but I do now." It was in the paper. "You won't believe me. I don't believe me. Does not believe self." Suze came. "Talk later because game's starting." 11 p.m., game begins. Last sighting of Rosie going out front door with me. No one else sees her. 11:15, Theo found, inside house, found by Sebastian. 11:30, Yash found, inside house, found by Sebastian and Theo together. Time unclear, but probably before midnight. Julian and Suze see Noel in back garden. 12:30, I am found, stables, found by Theo. 1, Peter found, back garden, found by Yash. 1:30, Suze, walled formal garden, found by Peter. 2:30, lights go out, Julian found, returned to house. 3 to 3:30, Suze sees torchlight at the side of house, coming from the general direction of the woodshed and drive.
"She was investigating the case," Stevie said. This was obvious, of course, but this treasury of documents was so monumental she couldn't help but state it out loud. "How did she get all of this?"
"She's a researcher," Izzy said. "That's her job. She knows people and knows how to get things. But this means the thing about the lock was real. What she said about thinking one of her friends was a murderer was real."
"Well," Stevie said, "it means that she was looking into the case, which she could still do even if she was looking for burglars who murdered her friends."
Izzy tapped on the timeline notes. "She's making notes about where everyone was," she said. "Because she thought one of them did it."
Stevie ran her eye over the pile. One of these things didn't belong. The newspaper article. It had nothing to do with the events at Meriwether.
"Body of missing American student found. The body of missing American student, Samantha Gravis, has been found in the River Cam near Grantchester Meadows. Local resident Donald Worth was walking his dog along the riverside early yesterday morning when his dog became attracted to something in an area of natural debris and overgrowth. As he tried to move his dog from the spot, he noticed what appeared to be a human form trapped in the collected sticks and plants. Police positively identified the victim as Samantha Gravis. Gravis, 18, was from Portland in the state of Maine. She had recently graduated from secondary school and was visiting England for the first time. She had been staying with a friend studying at Magdalen College. Gravis spent the week sightseeing and socializing. She was last seen by her friends at 2 a.m. on the morning of 15th June. The friends had been having a small party for Samantha's last night in Cambridge. She was planning to move on to London to continue her trip. Her friends said that Samantha was moderately inebriated and in very good spirits that night. She told them she had something she needed to do and refused the offer of company on her errand.
When she failed to return by the next morning, her friends went looking for her and then alerted the police. Gravis had expressed to her friends the desire to go punt running, the local Cambridge tradition of running along punts as they are tied up at dock. They had dissuaded her from doing so on previous occasions. From our conversations with her companions, we believe the deceased may have been inebriated and punt running, said Detective Chief Constable Nigel Rose. She had a small wound on the side of her face, consistent with a fall. We believe she was temporarily knocked unconscious, and she drowned. Her body drifted, and her foot became stuck on a shopping trolley that was on the bottom of the river. We must emphasize that punt running is extremely dangerous and results in many injuries. This tragic event is evidence of that. I assume this was what she means by the thing in the paper, Stevie said. Does this mean anything to you? Izzy read through the article and shook her head. No, she replied. No idea. I mean, aside from the fact that it's dated the same day as the murders. Stevie took the page back. She had missed that. Sloppy. She couldn't be sloppy. It didn't seem likely that Angela just collected newspaper articles from the day of the Merriweather murders. This person, Samantha Gravis, had something to do with the case. A quick Google search turned up very little. Nothing more than the article had provided. She was American. She was visiting Cambridge. She hit her head and fell into the river and died. An American girl falls into a river in Cambridge and dies, Stevie said. A week later, there's a story about it in the paper. That same day, the nine leave for Merriweather and two of them are murdered that night. Whoever Samantha Gravis is, she has something to do with this case. Stevie tapped her nails on the table. It was so much to take in. Okay, she looked at the pile of information. We need to read through all of this. They passed the documents around. Stevie began with the crime scene photos. The woodshed was a plain wooden structure with a peaked roof. The wood was variegated, brown in some places and an ashy black in others. It had a solid wooden door with peeling gray paint, partially open. Directly above it was a small ventilation window, much too small for a person, which was propped open a few inches. There were close-up photos of the door and the handle. The door had a rough wooden handle, and the lock system was a metal latch with a padlock. This had been ripped away with a crowbar or some other tool, splinting the wood. The lock was still intact. Just outside the woodshed, about 4 feet away, there was an overturned wheelbarrow and a bucket in the mud. The interior of the shed was dark in some photos. These revealed a plain, rough space, the back of which was covered in stacks of wood, which also spilled onto the floor. There were scattered tools on the ground. A rake, a shovel. Stevie had to squint to see the form of a human leg coming out of one of the piles. She did not have to squint in the next few photographs. These were illuminated by police lights, and they showed the true horror of what had taken place. She set the photos down and Izzy reached for them. Just so you know, Stevie said, they're rough. Izzy picked them up anyway and winced as she sifted through them. With the picture of the scene in her head, Stevie glanced through the autopsy report, not that there was much of a mystery as to what had killed Rosie and Noel. She exhaled slowly and looked out the window. The backs of houses were gone. Suddenly, they were somewhere entirely different, an open place, with great spreads of land cut through and quilted into patches by lines of trees or high hedges. Some of these patches of land had horses or sheep or cows grazing. They were in the country now. London was gone, and a different England presented itself. The spaces were wide and wild. And for the first time since this started, she felt a real sense of the danger here. Angela had not gone off to be by herself. Someone had taken her, because of this case, because of something she knew or might have been on the verge of knowing. And they were all going right into the heart of the beast, to Merriweather, to the Nine. 18. They disembarked at Cheltenham. There were several cabs waiting by the station, none of which were the fancy black cabs. They were just normal cars with decals on the side. David, Izzy, and Stevie got into the one, with Janelle, Nate, and Vi following right behind. "We're going to Merriweather," Izzy said to the driver.
"I know where it is, love," the driver replied. "I drive people there all the time for weddings."
They were off, down tight roads lined with cottages. Then they were out of the town, driving past fields neatly checkerboarded by hedgerows and rustic fences. The turns were many and tight, and came without warning. Stevie let out an involuntary low scream as a van came barreling right at them. Izzy smiled and patted her arm. The taxi driver, completely unfazed, pulled as far off to the side as humanly possible, the hedges scraping the car. The van squeezed by, inches from the cab.
"He just went the wrong way," Stevie said, turning around to watch it drive off.
"This is a two-way road," the driver said. "You're American? You have quite wide roads in America, don't you?"
This was not a two-lane road. This was a tiny, tiny, tiny path, surrounded by a high wall of greenery that blocked the view. It was a death trap, a meandering thread of madness. It suggested that there was something about English people that she may never understand. She looked to David, who had the decency to look a little startled himself, though he had not actually screamed. They turned down an even more narrow road, which ran along a low stone wall and ended in a gate. The driver, seemingly used to this, accessed a button that was concealed on a panel in the overgrowth. After a polite pause, the gate swung inward. They drove down a track between a higher brick wall and trees. And then the vista on the left opened onto something that was right out of any one of the many period dramas or mysteries that Stevie had seen. There was a vast house of sand-gold stone that seemed to be alive with climbing vines of a shocking autumnal red.
"Can't pull up the front," the driver said,
guiding the car into a gravel parking area off to the side. Moments later, the second car stopped next to them.
"I'm never doing that again," Nate said, stepping woozily out of the back of the car. "Whatever that Six Flags reject ride was."
"It was a small road," Janelle said, looking equally uncomfortable. Only Vi seemed to have enjoyed the experience.
"Hello,"
called a plummy English voice from the other side of a high brick wall.
"Hello."
A black gate in the wall opened, and Sebastian appeared. There was no mistaking him. He was more ample in his build now, his face a bit more jowly and his hair silvered. He was dressed in gray pants and a simple but likely expensive black sweater, with white detailing down the sleeves. He made his way quickly across the gravel, talking as he went.
"Oh, you're here. I hope the train ride was all right. Izzy, Izzy!"
He wrapped her in a massive embrace.
"Has there been news?"
he said, pulling back enough to look down at her. She shook her head.
"How are you?"
"I'm not sure," she said.
"Well, quite. But we're going to sort it all out, don't you worry. Now, is this everyone? Please introduce me."
Izzy made the round of introductions. Sebastian took note of all the names as she went, and then repeated them back correctly.
"Right,"
he said, clasping his hands together.
"Come through the front, won't you? I'll take you in the proper way."
He indicated a different gate through another high brick wall, which led into a private garden, lined with topiary, with benches and planted beds, with a winding gravel path.
"Welcome to Merriweather,"
he said, turning as he led them along past a small fountain. He put his arm over Izzy's shoulders and leaned in to speak to her. David fell in beside Stevie as they made their way through the twisting garden path.
"There's something going on in your head,"
he said quietly.
"I saw it on the train. What is it?"
"Can't," Stevie said in a low voice. "Not now." David frowned. There was a break in the topiary wall that Stevie didn't even see. Sebastian stepped up to it and led them to a long front stone porch. Did you call this a porch? Her house in Pittsburgh had a porch, with a crooked mailbox, a God Bless America banner, and two wicker chairs that housed generations of spiders. This was not a porch. This was a stone stage, balustraded, punctuated on the corners with lichen-marbled urns. Below it rolled lawns and gardens that seemed to stretch on for miles and miles, taking in the hills around, which were patchworked in dark green hedge lines and trees.
Far down, sheep grazed freely, baaing and milling around. It seemed like they were utterly alone in the world here, in a peaceful idyll. A stage waiting for an audience, that's what it was. Sebastian ushered them under a columned portico, in through an outer, then an inner door, into a grand, high-ceilinged hall. Even though there was a fair number of them coming into what should have been an echoing space, Stevie was immediately aware of how Meriwether seemed to eat sound. There was the grandfather clock by the stairs that made a loud, ticking heartbeat.
"They're here!"
Sebastian bellowed. His voice was big, a professional voice, which took up that void.
"You can set your things here, and leave your coats just there on that table."
He indicated a long side table with a marble top and no visible function. Above it hung a painting of a man with a shotgun and a dog, which felt like more of a warning than a greeting.
"Come through, come through," Sebastian said. "We're here in the sitting room. Just made some tea."
Of course there was tea. Stevie had started looking forward to it. This one had already been laid out on a large tray on an ottoman. Sitting by the fire was a black woman dressed in a gray cowl-neck sweater dress, black tights, and tall flat-soled boots. Her hair was cropped close to her head.
"You remember Theo,"
he said to Izzy.
"Of course."
Izzy accepted a hug from Theo. The introductions were made again. Theo, they were told, was an A&E physician at St. Thomas's Hospital in London.
"I've got everything organized,"
Sebastian said.
"All the rooms are ready. Suze will be here any moment. Peter and Yash are on the way. Julian will be coming later this evening, probably after dinner."
Tea and a few biscuits were quickly consumed. Then Sebastian guided them back out into the hall. Their American voices seemed to echo baldly through the space. The man in the painting was unimpressed. Even his dog wasn't happy about their sudden appearance. They went up the stairs, which were lined with portraits of people who looked like they hated being in portraits. There were so many paintings. Paintings of large, sweaty horses, fainting women, thin sunrises breaking over cottages and pastures, several ships in perilous seas, drooling labradors, a man in medieval clothing being stabbed through a curtain. It was sadness, seasickness, and dread in frame after gilded frame. And there were things everywhere. At the top of the stairs, a porcelain bowl sat on a small table for anyone to knock over. Against the wall, a cabinet full of fancy rocks? An oar above a door. A desk with a lute on it. Glass-fronted bookshelves, ancient framed photographs, a dish of old-fashioned keys, the jaw of a monstrous sea creature, possibly obtained in one of the sea battles pictured before, vases, more vases, a shepherdess made of china, rugs on top of rugs. It reminded Stevie of her grandparents, who had a serious addiction to buying things at yard sales and the harbor freight store. Except they had 6 air fryers, a whole bunch of old computer monitors, a dartboard from a bar, and a skee ball machine salvaged from a Chuck E. Cheese that had gone up in flames in an insurance fraud arson. This stuff was different. It was at least more expensive.
"I think I'll put you here, Izzy, in the bishop's room,"
Sebastian said, switching on the light in a sprawling bedroom with pale blue wallpaper and a 4-poster bed.
"Janelle, how about right here, the Rose Room? The ghost of my great-aunt lives in here, but all she ever does is move people's eyeglasses, so don't worry. She's otherwise charming. Vi? This way, darling. The De Vere Room. Nate, was it? Smashing room over here. The Regent Room. Stevie and David, right this way, round the corner. I've got 2 lovely rooms back here that face the garden."
David got a room called the Mountjoy Room. His was embracing shades of deep blue and green. Stevie was guided down 2 more doors.
"And here you go, Stevie," Sebastian said. "The Lilac Room. You might not be used to English heating. These houses get drafty. There are extra blankets in the chest at the foot of the bed."
"Thanks," Stevie said.
"Not at all, not at all. Let me just pop back downstairs and have a butcher's to see how dinner is coming along. Come and join us when you're ready."
Stevie had absolutely no idea what he meant by have a butcher's and was not going to ask. Once he was gone, she shut the door, took the fire safe from her suitcase, and stashed it under the bed. She went to the window and pushed it open. There were no screens on the windows, so she could lean out a bit and touch the climbing vines that surrounded the window and snaked up the walls. The garden seemed to be functional, with sections of green vegetables and herbs all set out in neat rows, supported with wires and many covered by arches of netting. Some pear trees grew flat along the wall and were heavy with fruit. Beyond the garden was more garden, and beyond that, green land rolling along, going right to the hills and the trees. England. Endless green England. It would be easy to fall out a window like this, she also noted. Lean out a bit too far to look at a rose or a cloud or a sheep, and you'd be sprawled on the terrace stones in no time, Agatha Christie style. She shut the window. The bathroom was nice. There was a massive clawfoot tub and a small sofa, just to sit on, in the bathroom. She sat on it for a few minutes, staring at the tub, pushing down an anxiety attack that threatened to rise. She breathed slowly, making her exhalations longer than her inhalations. Angela.